You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour this morning is Josh Swiller. Josh, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So the way we start the show is with the big open-ended question, just to kind of start the conversation, is who are you?
Let's start with the hard ones.
Yeah, we start, well, in a sense though, but what I want you to do is pick the low-hanging fruit so we can start climbing up the tree of knowledge, as it were, to get a sense of where do we start this conversation?
Well, first, thank you for having me here on this beautiful morning, Ithaca morning.
Ithacating very much.
I really don't know where to start to answer that question, because one of the things I am, I guess, is I've been a long time Zen student. Mm-hmm. And in Zen, you become very suspicious of having a specific answer.
Right.
Because then you got to wander around with one specific number on your chest or target on your back. And one thing that that kind of spiritual practice asks of us is to be open to the always changing nature, mm-hmm, of things and the always changing nature of ourselves.
Right, which means that the answer to the question is a quality as opposed to a label.
Oh, I like that.
And that's where the people who come onto the show with the deepest spiritual practice, whether they're Christian or Buddhist or Jewish or Hindu or Muslim, they go for the quality, because it's the quality of life that we seek, that we aspire to, that says more about ourselves often than the labels that we happen to have wandered through.
I like that. I would say the quality right now is a little bit sleepy, as my my 5-month-old was up all night. But I think also the quality or the quality we aspire to is shining. Mm-hmm. I think the purpose of Zen practice or of any spiritual practice is to shine. Mm-hmm. And to shine doesn't mean to rule the world or to be the biggest boss or to be the most famous person, but just to be as open in our hearts as possible. And then all life, all day long, we come across things that go, that want to clench, that want to close us down, mm-hmm, and how we meet them and open them and release them and shine. And that's kind of the quality of it.
And yeah, and I want to stay with this. You've started with a very profound spiritual practice and concept. When you meet something that would cause one to clench, how is it that you release it? What do you mean by that? I mean, this is in the back of my head is a Christian and a Jewish statement that, you know, the light shines in the darkness and the darkness doesn't overcome it, but also it doesn't overcome the darkness exactly. Mm. And there are those who say of God, who are theists, that there is, you know, that darkness and light are the same to the truth or the reality that's called God.
Mm.
And I'm trying to figure out, are you saying something similar or different? Or
well, we have to like stand our ground in gratefulness and thankfulness in love. And so we come across, say, I don't want to be here. This is too hard. Mm-hmm. And we can, you know, I think we're taught in our society just fight through that or just ignore that. But sometimes it's better to just be with that, mm-hmm, and almost like hold it in your arms. Like, you know, I picture like holding my young child, mm-hmm, and just hold that fear, hold that, mm-hmm, clench, hold that darkness, hold that refusal to shine, hold that worry that, oh, there's something wrong with me, mm-hmm, and just to hold it in light, in gentleness, in kindness, and that's what it wants, that's all it wants, and then it can unwind.
And by unwind, what do you mean?
I mean that our true nature is light. our true nature is shining. Mm-hmm. It's not the wound. Mm-hmm. And so the wounds can seem so real, and they can seem so, they can speak so eloquently about where we've gone wrong, mm-hmm. or what our flaws are, but they're not the truth about us. The truth about us is that we were put on this planet to marvel and at everything, at this creation, to love this world. Mm-hmm. And so practice, in a way, spiritual practice, at least as I've understood it, has just been about making that connection to the light, mm-hmm. easier and freer. And so when a darkness comes up, mm-hmm. in whatever form, and it can be fear of death, it can be, oh God, this guy is cutting in front of me in traffic, you know?
Right. Or it can be a fear of guns. I mean, this is what we've seen a lot lately. I mean, the fear of guns is almost as mm-hmm. as damaging as the overly aggressive embrace of guns.
You know, we just got, this is kind of random, but we just got Netflix. And so we started watching this show called The Great British Baking Show or something. And then before that, we were watching a show called Chopped. And so they're two cooking shows and they're two competitions. And it Chopped, which is the American show, mm-hmm. it's so stressful. It's like the way it's edited and the way they have these interviews with the competitors. You know, mm-hmm. if I don't win these $10,000, I'm going to be a failure as a chef. I've got to do it. And then they race around frantically and the clock is ticking to the hundredth of a second and everyone's so stressed out and I just got to get it on the plate. And then you have the British version, which is the baking show, where they're like, okay, competitors, you have 4 hours. Here's a recipe to help you and, you know, have some fun. And uh-huh. it's a competition still, but uh-huh. it's just, and so when we getting back to guns, mm-hmm. I think we become such a fear-based society on so many levels yeah. because we've really lost touch with the light in us. And so it's all about, I've got to win. I've got to win. Instead of, you know, hey, it's a beautiful day. I'm making bacon wrapped monkfish or something for $10,000. Why can't I enjoy that?
Yeah. So you brought some music with you.
I did.
And we're going to start with a piece by Van Morrison called Cleaning Windows. And do you want to say anything before we play that? Or do you want to, to let it speak for itself?
Yeah, I'll say a little bit. I'm actually completely 100% deaf. I hear with a cochlear implant that I got 10 years ago. And before that, I had hearing aids. And, excuse me, too much coffee. And I've always loved Van Morrison for several reasons. First, he sings beautifully just about the spiritual perspective. Mm-hmm. Not so much preaching at you, but just awing along with you. And second, I love that his lyrics are always very clear and not hidden by super loud guitar chords or anything like that. So I could always follow what he was singing mm-hmm. about.
There's an earnestness to his music too.
Yes, there is. Yeah.
The bakery from across the street got in my nose. Yeah. Yeah, we carried our letters down the street with the wrought iron gate rose. I went home and listened to Jimmy Rogers in my lunch break. Woodbine at the shop on the corner and went straight back to work. Oh, Sam was up on top and I was on the bottom with the V. at the shop and broke for tea. That's it. I collected from the lady and I cleaned the fan light inside out. I was blowing saxophone on the weekend in a down joint. What's my life? I'll help be cleaning windows. Take my time. I'll see you when my love grows. Baby, don't let it slide. I'm a working man in my prime, cleaning windows. Number 36. I'm a rolling stone. I went home and read my Christmas Humphrey's book on Zen. Curiosity killed the cat. Kerouac's storm of bumps and on the road. What's my life? I'm happy cleaning windows. Will I take my time? I'll see you when my love grows. Don't let it slide. I'm a working man in my prime, cleaning windows.
And that was Van Morrison and Cleaning Windows. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Josh Swiller. So before the show, Josh and I had an exchange about whether music was the right way to go with a person who is functionally deaf.
Mm.
And I offered the opportunity to do it a different way, but you have a relationship with music. You have a powerful relationship. Even though you live in silence, too.
You asked me, yeah, what do I use to recharge besides music? And for me, the greatest thing about cochlear implants is being able to take them off. Because as soon as I flip off that magnet, it is stone quiet. It is as quiet as the moon. And I think, I think five senses is a lot. And sometimes it's overwhelming. And then every now and then getting to cut that to four is really nice.
I you're making me remember something. As a young child, I was one of seven children, and I was extremely sensitive hearing. So we lived in a two bedroom house, so very small, very tight space. And so I would go and close the door to the closet where I could get something less jarring than the noise of all my older siblings, because I was the sixth of seven.
Yeah, it's there's a real movement going on and a study going on just about how silence deprived we are and how important it is to be silent and how important it is to have quiet spaces to recharge. And, for many years I lived in the deaf community, and my wife is deaf and signing deaf, and the community has a real heart to it, a soulfulness that I think partially comes from people being in silence all the time. Because in you know, getting back to our original conversation about unwinding things mm-hmm. in peace, in unwinding them in light or in love or whatever word you want to use,
unwinding silence. Or nesting, or like yeah, you hold your five month old baby, or you hold something in your hand not to crush it with your anxiety, but right. to just hold it and right. see what it brings.
Right, and just to hold the anxiety, and in other mm-hmm. words. Yeah. And to see, well, wait a minute, if I'm holding the anxiety, then I'm not this anxiety.
Right.
And then, oh, that can start to release. And so silence is a great aid in that. And so I often, sometimes I give talks in, about deafness to different agencies, to different people. And there's the signing deaf community, which is very comfortable with silence. And mm-hmm. then there's the oral deaf community, which sees it sometimes as like an enemy to be beaten. And I try and tell them, you know, it can be a tool too. It can be a wonderful thing. People have, I work with parents who have deaf children, and they're hearing and they're very concerned that their parents aren't hearing and they want, I mean, that their children aren't hearing and they want the children to get hearing at all costs. And it becomes like a war mm-hmm. against silence. And a war you can't win.
Right.
And so what I work with them sometimes is, all right, let's not make it a war. Let's become friends with silence mm-hmm. and start their child's education from that point of view.
And in the spirit of that question or that issue, how is it that you chose to get a cochlear implant?
Well, you know, I grew up oral. I grew up hearing. I grew up not hearing, but what's the word? Just getting speech therapy. I had 12 years of speech.
So you were coached to speak, even if you couldn't hear well.
I was diagnosed severe to profoundly deaf at about 3 years of age, or four maybe. Before then, they just thought I was a little slow. They couldn't figure out, why isn't he learning language? And then they went to the doctor and they said, that's why. And then I had 12 years of speech therapy. And so that has always been the modality of communication I'm most comfortable with.
Uh-huh.
My wife is most comfortable with sign language. And so when I got to be about 30, I lost the rest of my hearing, and hearing aids no longer worked. Because for years, my hearing kept getting worse, and I kept getting more and more powerful hearing aids, which makes them worse, makes hearing worse, and et cetera. And then finally, I reached a point of no return. And so I thought, I'll give this a shot. I got nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it's a zero-sum thing where you are hearing and you can't be in the signing community. Where, right. And so over the last decade, you know, the more better my hearing has gotten, the better my signing has gotten too. So
because your conceptual world has grown and you have...
Nah,
because
I fell in love with a woman who signs beautifully, and I realized I needed to up my game. That's the best way to learn.
Love is a much more powerful, though at times hard to understand, motivator than hate, and they both work.
I've never... Not sure I know many people who have learned how to sign out of hate.
No, but no. Desperation, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes. So how... You have, in a certain sense, slipped into deafness. And how has that changed... I mean, how has that shaped your life? In terms of, you know, what kinds of things did you have to go through in order to accept it? And who did you have to deal with? Who did you have to bump up against?
That's a beautiful question, because in some ways I think deafness was absolutely my first spiritual teacher, and a beautiful one. It constantly puts something in front of my face, you know, when you're a teenager and you want to be like everyone else, or at least be liked by everyone else. I couldn't even understand everyone else. So it was constantly putting something in front of my face that didn't seem fair, that didn't seem right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I tell people, you know, people are like, why is the deaf community oh, he's so emotional and upset and aggravated because there's often riots and protests going there. And I tell people, because deafness is closer to them than God, because every second it's right there. It's right. So here was a thing that was right there that I was alone in the hearing world with, that had no easy answers,
mm-hmm.
and was saying, and I realized I needed to love it. To love, I couldn't fight it off. I had to find a way to love and make peace with it. So it became a great teacher.
Mm.
A great teacher. And I also think it taught in another way, in that, in the perspective it gave, because it gives a certain distance. I remember once, I might have been in college, I had a summer job working at some law firm in New York City, next to the paralegals and all that, and it wasn't exciting.
Like a runner or a process server?
Yeah. I don't even know what, yeah. but I can't remember. I blocked it out. but you know, I would work often with my, I was doing a lot of input, and I would work often with my hearing aids off, completely quiet. And all of us peons would sit in the hallway while the partners were in their big offices. And then the partners would come out of their offices, and I'm watching all this, my hearing aids off, in complete silence. And just treat each other like such. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what words I can use. Like such, you know, like. Oh, sorry, all the words that are coming to mind, I'm not sure I can use. But, and I was like, you know, maybe these people are putting together briefs to stop someone from death row.
Mm-hmm.
Although more likely they were trying to get Donald Trump another tax break. But
or a few extra stories up
above. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But what is it worth if you're going to treat each other like mm-hmm. that? So, and I think in a way, deafness made me step back and go, wait a minute. How is a goal worth the means to get there if mm-hmm. you're going to treat people like that?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just watching it. And maybe if I'd heard the words clearly, I would have been like, oh, he has a point. But all I saw was people putting each other down and treating each other poorly. And so deafness was a teacher in that way. Mm-hmm. It just gave me perspective. At first, it asked me to accept it unreservedly. And then second, it said, see, you don't have to treat people this way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does it make a difference that you learned to love your deafness before you got the implant?
Well, I'd also say that love is a quality.
Yeah. So it's, with it beats in various breaths.
It was an ongoing process mm-hmm. for years. I think it was sidetracked for years, where I thought in college, I know the way to love this is to just put a lot of alcohol into it, which is, I think, how a lot of people approach it. Self-doubts in college. And
yeah, that's right. That's right. It's not unique to deafness. It's insecurity in profound ways.
Not at all. I don't know. I think I have the wonderful grace and karma to have a uncle who is a Zen master.
Mm-hmm.
And he took a notice of me kind of stumbling around, banging into things, and searching hard, but not knowing what I was searching for, mm-hmm. which is like how a lot of spiritual practice starts. You know, it's kind of very profound and simple, but hard to say, I'm just looking for complete happiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm looking for a happiness that's untouched by pain. And so we think, I don't know what I'm looking for. I just, the perfect relationship, the perfect that. And he sort of reached out and and guided me. Mm-hmm. And this is the David Radin, who runs the Ithaca Zen Center up in Danby. And so I made my way to Ithaca in the early 90s or mid 90s after I was in the Peace Corps. And it kind of naturally transitioned from studying silence by myself with my hearing aids off to studying silence, sitting in a room with some other practitioners, hoping my knees didn't break from sitting cross-legged for so long.
You mentioned finding happiness I think there are many languages to use for that, and I want to just play with a couple of other languages.
Sure.
Particularly for Christians who tend to get tripped over the truth language. And in this sense, the happiness is the truth that sets you free. It's seeing things with a compassion that allows you to continue to engage them, that allows a relationship to unfold eternally.
That's beautifully said.
And that's, in a sense, that's where the Buddhist practice and the Christian practice can come closer together.
Sure. Yeah, I think, I hesitate to call myself a Buddhist because it just puts a label on something that doesn't even
mean.
And then to say, I think all the good spiritual teachers are talking about the same thing.
And where they don't seem to be talking about the same thing, that seems interesting. So let me hold on to it.
Yeah, it's like we live, like we were talking earlier, live in a fearful time. Mm-hmm. And I think we see a rise of fundamentalism because of that, and that's Christian fundamentalism, Jewish and Islamic, because... Yep. It says,
and even in places Buddhist.
Yeah, in Buddhist, because here's a hard answer.
Here's
what you need to do. Yeah. And it gets very clear and hard answers. And it's much, much harder to really surrender and say, I don't have the answers. I'm just going to be open and kind and compassionate.
Right. And I'm going to have the hard questions to which the answer might be one approach. But the question behind that hard answer is much more profound usually than the answer, and pushing my I want to honor the way in which you want to deflect the labels. I want to throw the labels because I want to create imagery that people can react to and then step back from, because my job as being something of a court jester in life is to give people things to both take seriously, to laugh at.
It's an enduring, maybe, frustration and tragedy that people think they can completely understand life through its labels, through words, through an intellectual understanding. And it's so much more than that. Yeah. It's so beyond, I'm sitting here using words like light and love, but those don't even begin to grasp. It's like... one pixel of a huge screen.
What I've tried to do to suggest, I want to come back to a couple of things you said, but in this digression, I encourage people to analyze things from three points of view that I consider orthogonal or independent of each other. One is intellectual accuracy. Mm-hmm. The other one is emotional honesty. Mm-hmm. And the third is does it engage the senses? And if it hits all three, then it's human communication in its fullness. And when you see its fullness, it has a spiritual or a soulful quality to it. But it needs to kind of be in all three. In an age of fundamentalism is the most rationalistic, most intellectual version of any religion. And, and science is important, but if it's just about reason, then it's not human communication. Mm-hmm. It's really good, but it's not sufficient. And we live in this time where our fears are being provoked because we don't have the tools to live in a more compelling way. You were talking about many people reacting to the, quote, emotionality of deaf persons in their response to the world. Mm-hmm. My sense is that's
If I can say something about that. in every single conversation with a deaf person, a signing deaf person,
sure,
you have eye contact.
Yeah.
Because the adjectives are on the face. Emotions are on the face.
And the hands and the body.
Right. So you have to stop what you're doing and have eye contact. You can't be texting. You can't be looking at the TV. You can't be cooking, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that is amazingly profound and powerful.
Yep.
I think I remember reading somewhere that looking into someone's eyes for like 5 or 10 minutes can induce a like an hallucinogenic state.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm familiar with some of that.
So
the popularizing of that approach too.
So getting back to what you were saying about communication,
mm-hmm.
you know, someone once asked my teacher, what's the point of spiritual practice?
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher had just been describing like a meditation retreat where you wake up like at this ungodly hour and you sit for hours and breaks for meals and then go to sleep and then do it again and then do it day after day after day for 7 days. And someone asked him, what's the point? And his answer still just gives me chills. He just looked in this man's eyes and said, how are you? That's it. How are you? Not, I have now have attained level 8 spiritual power or something that.
But
just to be able to have open and kind and genuine communication.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The point is to be fully present and getting rid of all of the stuff that gets in the way of being present.
Yeah.
Or as much as you can without being perfectionist about it.
Yeah. That's the other thing. Yeah. You screw it up 500 times a day.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Especially if you're married. But that's okay.
Yeah. Marriage and the crash course in forgiveness in all directions. Let's cut to music. What would you like to play next?
How about the next song's good. Wonderful Remark.
Wonderful Remark. Okay. And we will probably cut into it just because this conversation's hopping along. Van Morrison, Wonderful Remark. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.
How can you stand the silence that pervades when we all cry? How can you watch the violence that erupts before your eyes? How can you tell us something just to keep us hanging on? Something that just don't mean nothing. When we see it, you are gone. Clinging to some other rainbow, or standing waiting in the cold, telling us the same old story, knowing time is growing old. That was a wonderful remark. I told a million lies to myself, to myself. To you, when we know your talk is cheap, how can we ever question why we give more and you keep? How can your empty laughter fill the room like our like a child of a good toy. How can we ever feel the freedom or the flame lit by the spark? How can we ever come out even when reality is stark? That was a wonderful remark. I had my eyes closed in the dark. Yeah. I saw a million sighs. I told a million lies to myself. To myself.
And that was Van Morrison and Wonderful Remark. And our guest on this hour is Josh Swiller. I just wanted to misname you. I get so involved sometimes in the conversations and the transitions that I lose track of where I am, which is not necessarily a bad thing. So Josh, you are a cranial sacral therapist. You also writing a book. And so what are some of these things that you care about that kind of keep you going these days?
everything we're talking about. And in a way, both cranial sacral therapy and what I'm writing, I feel kind of build on our earlier discussion of how can we find compassion for things. How can we find, hold things in light so that they can release? Mm-hmm. Cranial sacral therapy is not maybe the most well-known kind of therapy. It's very gentle, and really it is just about holding our wounds, be they physical, emotional, spiritual, just holding them with gentleness so that they can release.
It's a mix of conversation and touch and emotion.
Not really so much conversation. It's a conversation with the client's system.
I see. Yeah.
Excuse me one second. Cranial sacral refers to the cranial sacral fluid, which bathes the brain, which runs down the spinal cord, bathing the whole spinal cord down to the sacrum. Mm-hmm. And there's a blood-brain barrier, so no blood gets into the brain. So this fluid kind of contains us in a way. Mm-hmm. And it has a record, if you will, of the wounds and injuries and stresses and traumas that we may have experienced going back to when we were in the womb.
And I would imagine also the pleasure.
Yes.
The other side of
absolutely.
The coin.
And that's the other side of the coin is when you're working with someone in a cranial sacral way, you can't fix them. You can't beat out their trauma, but you can try and what you work with them to do is to ground in what feels good, to ground in the light and let their health do the work. Mm-hmm. Let their health heal.
Let the darkness and the light be there, but they stand in the light without denying the darkness.
Right, exactly. And it's just, I had a thriving career as a writer and I had no need for another career, but I got some sessions after a car accident about 5-6 years ago and I was so blown away. I was like, I have to learn how to do this. Mm-hmm. And I did a 2.5-year training and I've been practicing here in Ithaca for a year and a half and it continues to blow my mind every session. I could give some examples. So.
Sure.
I had a client who, just had a persistent state of anxiety that just felt overwhelming all over her body. And it had been something her whole life. And then in the course of work, it came out that when she was in the womb, her mother was extremely, her father was abusive to the mother. So the mother was very fearful and very kind of clenched in and nervous. And that hormonal energy got diffused into the fetus, which is, you know, wide open at that point. And we were able to process and release that. And beautiful, beautiful. And then there's just other stuff, things. It's almost like the human system is this giant spider web and how it all fits together. So I had one client who had terrible insomnia, and we just worked through the levels of that. One of them was a car accident when he was 18. Another was his father saying, you know, you need to do better, and just really just, you know, pushing that straight A pressure onto him. And just some of these things get into our system when they're so young that they really, they almost start to make up our system.
Right.
Because our defenses aren't there. But they can be released. They can be released because we are at bottom light and not the wounds.
So I'm guessing that your writing is also exploring these themes.
Yeah, you know, I, how do I put it? I've been in the spiritual community and in this world, you know, for many years. And I got to thinking, you know, how would I want to read about this if I was like a teenager? Because I have two boys, you know, how would I get this across to them? And, you know, they're watching the Hunger Games, or they will be.
Yeah.
So, you know, start talking about darkness and light, and I'm sure they're just going to zone right out. So I kind of got the idea of taking these themes we've been talking about and kind of putting it in a Hunger Games world where what saves the world isn't, you know, shooting the bad guy through the heart with a flaming crossbow, but with learning to open your own heart. And so it took a long time to think about it. A couple meditation periods, just sitting there, this could happen. But came up with a structure to dramatize how the thing that saves us is our compassion, is our light, and not victory.
Right. Right. And this, what I hear you saying is, it's not succumbing. It's not an either or situation where you either have to win or you lose, but it's a way that you hold your own,
I think,
and hold the other.
Yeah. You know, I think also, I think it's a tough time to be young. I think the younger generation is constantly being told that the world is scary, that it's going to hell, that climate change is here and it's not going away. And that's, there's some truth to all that, but what they're not being told, or not being told enough, is that the world is magic. The world is magic. And I don't think the world can really be healed if we don't start from that place. Oh, I had a thought and it just went right out the window.
As you continue thinking about that, what I want to, we also confuse nihilism with pleasure. And in that sense, that fuels addiction to drugs, violence, sex, all sorts of stuff, in a way to find happiness that doesn't really provide happiness, except maybe in the actual moment. But what you're talking about is a way of trying to open a door to an acceptance of a level of complexity And that you can engage without having to feel like a winner or a loser. But gosh, isn't this wonderful? And isn't this interesting? And the magic isn't a disconnect with reality. It's a far fuller embrace of it.
Beautiful. Yeah. And I would say an acceptance of a level of complexity, but more like an acceptance of a level of simplicity.
Well, yeah, and as they go together, yes.
But one metaphor I like is, you know, I have a 3-year-old son, and when he's hitting his little brother, I can't help him, teach him from the place of, you're going to hell.
Right.
But I have to start in the place of, I love you. And in the world now, it feels like everyone is starting in the place of, we're going to hell. Instead of in the place of, I love you. This is magic.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is kind of what I was trying to get across in the book.
Yeah. So, and the I love you, this is magic approach is also not about self-righteousness.
No.
Which is where we tend to go. We have the pacifist answer. We have the right nonviolent approach. That's not what you're talking about.
No, it's very tricky.
It's a very, very delicate balance of accepting what is and loving it into what it's not yet.
Yeah, it can become very tricky, especially in presidential election years.
Yeah,
you know where you know. Everyone's candidate has the answer. But it's almost getting back to simplicity. Mm-hmm. It's almost like before we get into those kind of answers, right, let's just meet on a common ground of God. Thank God for this miracle of getting to be here.
Right. I want to take off on a couple of different lines now towards the last quarter of the show. How have you had to reinvent yourself in ways that you would never have chosen, but it's proved to be helpful? How has life forced you to change in ways that you really weren't looking for or weren't necessarily open to?
Well, getting back to something my teacher said when I was first coming around to practice regularly, he said, all my best students are suicidal or desperate.
Yeah. Yes.
And I came in that place.
And he didn't try to chase you out of this place either, or she, he or she didn't try to chase you out.
Not at the time. I was working with deafness. I went to the Peace Corps after college, you know, thinking, you know what? What I need is to find a place with a cause so intense, with needs so great, that my own pains and desperation won't matter.
Yeah, it'll melt away.
Didn't work. Didn't work. And I also, you know, not to make it about myself, just saw tremendous suffering.
That you weren't prepared to deal with.
No, that I wasn't. And that took many years to unpack. But that also has a lot of great wisdom in it. If I could tell a story, sure. There's a saying in Peace Corps that volunteers who go to South America and Central America, they come back politically active and politically aware. And volunteers who go to Southeast Asia, they come back spiritually active or spiritually curious. And then volunteers who go to Africa, which is where I went, they come back drunk and laughing. Now, the drunk part, not so important.
Yeah, yeah.
But the laughing part, I think, is a very, very deep thing that if you can face all this, the sorrows and suffering and smile. And that's something that people did in the village. They all had buried a child, pretty much. So there was no, life owes me more than this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Nelsons next door didn't bury a child. Mm-hmm. It was, I still have some children. It's a nice day. I have food in my stomach. I can be happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I have a dear friend who before Christmas was very, very depressed and in the shadows, and was there was no light, and the darkness was all around her, and the darkness was suicide. And we sat with that for an hour, hour and a half. And a week later, we came back, and she was singing Happy Death Day to me, Happy Death Day. So she had accepted it and began to laugh at it and to, in a certain sense, laugh death in the face. And that is potent healing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, in the end.
And that's I think, behind your Africa story.
Yeah, and just... in a way, behind all spiritual practice, you know, the one thing we know about this life is that it ends. Is that it ends. And so to get to that point completely unprepared seems a little ridiculous. But that's how our culture is set up. That's
how our culture does it. And you know, many of the people that I work with are in their eighth and ninth decade. And they still haven't really squared off with it. And it's an important thing to do before you die.
Yes. Yeah, I would think so. And I think, you know, like that's where the light really helps, just to completely surrender to a moment and the joy in a moment. Then there's no room for regret. There's no room for the thought, oh, I need another 10 years, or, oh, I didn't, if I'd only bought Apple stock when it was lower. But, you know, it was just completely open. And so the grace of life is available to us in every moment. The freedom from the fear of death is available all the time.
How did you make the transition in Africa from shock and horror to, in a sense, humility and humor? What happened to you in that process?
It took years. Okay. I mean, I think I came back with PTSD.
Right.
And I was in bus crashes, you know, children die everywhere.
But they die in public in ways there that they don't die in public here.
No, I was working in a health clinic, so and in my village, I would say about one of every three children under five died, mostly from waterborne disease, some malaria. I mean, first of all, it's really just, you know, a little bit of a slap in the face, like, wake up, what is important?
And you see your privilege or your distance from reality only after you've been immersed and then leave.
Sure.
And which is why I think it takes years. It's not, it doesn't have to involve PTSD, but it often does. And that's not necessarily a curse. That is also a teacher.
Exactly. Something else that wants to unwind in the light of our being. But it, you know, so practice was great for that. Sitting there sometimes, what's this anxiety? Oh, this is the bus about to crash 5 years ago. Oh, let's let this go.
And to hear your telling of your experience of Africa in the Peace Corps is different than a couple of other guests I've had who've been in Africa on the Peace in the Peace Corps.
Well, you know, one of the things about Peace Corps is...
But they have similar themes. How they reacted to that disconnect was different. But the explosive moment was very similar.
And one of the things about Peace Corps is... you really see how your life is not separate from you. So here in the States, you know, we have our families and our hobbies and our jobs.
Sure.
But there in Africa, it's just you and where you are. Mm-hmm. And so there were eight people in my group in Peace Corps, and all of us had a different experience.
Yeah.
And all of us, but all of us had experience true to who we were.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so you really becomes very clear, oh, wait a minute, what happens in this world is not separate from who I am. Yep. Whereas here in the States, with our busy lives, that can get lost.
Yeah. And I want to universalize from that observation. A lot of what we want in this culture, particularly in this political and economic culture, are objective answers. but we are subjects who see the world and experience it in our own unique ways. So what is more helpful is a disciplined subjectivity that we can share and reflect with each other to test and to get, rather than any kind of thin claim to objectivity, which will not last, which will not hold in most instances when you're dealing with human beings.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that in quantum physics these days. They're doing all this research that's showing you can't separate the observed from the observer. Right. That if you look at something this way, it's an electron. If you look at it the other way, it's a wave. Mm-hmm. And it's not the thing, it's how you look at it.
Right. Or even that you look at it.
Yeah, yes.
What I want to close with is, what do you do on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis to sustain yourself? How do you take care of your body and your mind and your emotion, your heart?
It's good to take time to sit in silence. And, you know, I tell people it doesn't have to be sitting on a cushion, because sometimes people put such pressure on themselves to do that. Mm-hmm. Maybe when you're driving from place to place, throw your phone in the back seat, turn off the radio, and just be in silence.
And being in silence doesn't mean you can't be doing something else.
Yeah. Exactly. Right. It doesn't. And in a way, it's an easier meditation in a way, if you're driving, to just be driving. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes when you're just sitting, it's the volume of your thoughts gets turned up to 11, and that can be overwhelming. But when you're driving, just driving. And then here comes a thought along saying, oh my God, I have so much to do today. But wait, you just got to make a right turn.
Yeah. Yep. So that helps to center you. What else do you do on a daily or weekly or monthly basis?
As I'm sure many people can tell you, having young children is a very humbling and profound spiritual practice in surrendering
your time, surrendering your days, your time, your weeks, and your months,
your sleep,
yes,
your dreams, your hopes,
yeah,
your movie nights, yeah, everything,
yeah,
and that's
where you are now.
But you know, I think we're also exceptionally lucky to be in this community, in this beautiful stretch of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, and I live on a road. Sometimes just taking my dog for a walk on this dirt road. Trees overhead, skies blowing, snow coming down. What else do we need?
Yeah. Josh, it's been really, really good to get to know you.
Thank you. Pleasure's been mine.
And we're going to close with another Van Morrison tune called Evening Meditation. Do you want to say something about it?
It's just a simple meditation instrumental. I just want to say it's been a pleasure, and thank you for this opportunity. Oh,
you are so welcome. It's really good to get to know the beauty of your life.